Shuli Mishkan for the final of her four-part series in archaeology, and we're looking forward, I think, Yerushalayim, the 6 days. And thank you, Vakasha. Hey, Shuli, it's all yours, and the Torah Motion Zoom channel is ready to go.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. All right. Hi, everybody. So we are going to do something a little bit different this time. The first three classes, we really focused on Tanakh sites and how archaeology and Tanakh contribute to each other, sometimes contradict each other. Today, we are going to do Tanakh, but not only. We're really going to focus on a place and the particular excavations that happen there. And for that, let's go into screen sharing and start to tell the story, because it really is an amazing, amazing story. Okay, so of the many miracles of the Six-Day War, and there are many, starting with the physical miracles and the fact that it was not at all clear, people who were around, who remember, it was not at all clear that Israel would survive, and God forbid there would be a destruction 19 years after Israel had been created. And instead, there was a complete turnabout, and Israel had an amazing victory. So besides the physical salvation, there was also the spiritual, historical element of returning to all these places that are really the heartland of the Jewish people, Hebron, Shiloh, Beit El, so many places like that. So many unbelievable stories about the Six-Day War, but there was a lesser known miracle, and that is the opportunity to dig in the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem. Of course, with the Six-Day War, we returned to the Old City, right? The Old City that we had been exiled from the end of May 1948, where the Jews surrender because they are losing in the terrible battle, terrible, terrible battles in 1948 in the Jewish quarter of the Old City, and finally, the Jews have to leave. 19 years later, the return, really an incredible return, and we've seen the footage of Mota Gor and Rav Shlomo Goren on the Temple Mount, right? Har HaBayit Biyadenu, the Temple Mount is in our hands. And all of that is incredible, but there's also the story of the Jewish quarter, and that's the story that we are going to be telling today. Don't worry, I'm not going to talk about this menorah now, but we are going to come back to it because it really is a great discovery. But we will come back to it. But first, let's understand where we are going. So I am hoping that a lot of people here are familiar with the Jewish quarter of today. But let's just understand a little bit where we are going to be going on this virtual tour, which I have done as a real tour. So we are going to go in chronological order, all right? We're going to start here at the Broad Wall, really in the heart of the Jewish quarter, just so that you are, actually, let's do it differently. Let's understand where we are, right? Here is the Dung Gate, Shar HaShpot, the gate that you go into to get to the Kotel, to the Western Wall Plaza, right? Over here, these are the excavations by the southern wall down here. We're not going to be looking at that, even though that's important as well, but that's a different story. Okay. Up here, we have the Zion Gate, Mount Zion. Jaffa Gate is out in this direction. Okay, so we are looking at the Jewish quarter itself, right? The quarter that is between Zion Gate and Dung Gate. And the sites that we're going to be looking at primarily, with a little bit of, extras on the side, okay, we're going to be going to the Broad Wall over here. We're going to be taking a look at the Cardo, right? The amazing story of the Cardo. We are going to be looking at the Wohl Archaeological Museum, right? What's sometimes better known as the Herodian Quarter, the houses underneath Yeshivat HaKotel, okay, as well as the Burnt House, which is part of the same story, not too far away from it. So that's just a very, very small area, okay, but that's where we are going to be going. When I do this tour in real life, the whole thing takes maybe 3 hours, even though to walk from one site to the other would take you 10 minutes, not even, okay, but there's a lot to unpack here. So what is so special, what is so unusual about the discoveries in the Jewish quarter? Before we get to that, just a very quick timeline to understand the main time periods of the discoveries. We're going to be talking about late First Temple times, okay, the time of King Hezekiah up until the destruction of the temple. We're going to be talking about Second Temple times, let's say mid-Second Temple, from around the time period of Hanukkah, of the Hashmonaim, second century before the Common Era, the Herodian time period, meaning from around the time of Herod, which is the first century, the end of the first century before the Common Era, until the destruction of the Second Temple. And that's really going to be our richest time period. We're going to see so much from then. And we're also going to touch on Roman and Byzantine times, okay? The Cardo, the Nea Church. We're not going to really look at, but be aware that it was discovered, the Crusader period, right? Crusader times, a marketplace, a large building that might be a church, but we're not going to focus on that, even though there is what to talk about there as well. But we will have plenty to do with the periods that we have talked about. So what is so extraordinary about the Jewish Quarter? Okay, so what you guys are looking at here is a photograph of the Jewish Quarter from before 1948. How do I know that it's before 1948? Well, I have a few clues. First of all, everything is packed, 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 very, very packed in. Okay, we also can see down here by the Kotel, by the Western Wall, this is the Kotel, you have houses that go almost all the way up to the Western Wall, which is how it looked like up until 67. If you've seen old pictures of the Kotel, it was this very, very narrow alleyway with a neighborhood, right? The Mugrabi neighborhood that went almost up to the wall itself, okay? The Jewish Quarter, which is up here, is packed, 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 more packed than it is today. No open squares, no playgrounds, no nothing, okay? And perhaps the most telling piece in the photograph is the Churva Synagogue, which as some of you may know, has been rebuilt, but only 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And the Tiferet Yisrael Synagogue, which is in the process of being rebuilt, but has definitely not been rebuilt. I'm just going to remind everybody that you can write any questions you want in the chat. I'm going to look at them at the end. Okay, so this is clearly a picture from before the destruction of these synagogues. And what we see in this picture is how incredibly dense the Jewish Quarter is. Now, the Jewish Quarter is an amazing place because it's the part of the old city that goes, the part of the old city within the walls that goes back the oldest, meaning the city of David is older, but this is the part within the walls. And it's been more or less continuously settled for how long? Well, now we know 2,700 years. They didn't know that when they got started, but they knew that it was definitely continuously settled for at least 2,000 years. So what does that tell us? That tells us two things. Number one, there's an incredible amount of archaeological richness to be discovered here. Number two, you can't get to it because it's underneath these deeply, densely packed in buildings. You can't go to somebody's house, knock on the door and say, hi, I'd really like to knock down your house so that I can see the archaeology underneath. So while we knew there was much to see, and while there were a few efforts here and there, let's say in the 19th century, Charles Warren and the Palestine Exploration Fund to try and see what's underneath, it really was a more or less impossible task. And then something happened that was very dramatic, not particularly good, but very dramatic. And that's the War of Independence in 1948. The Jewish Quarter was one of the hardest hit places in the whole land of Israel in the war. From partition, November 29th, 1947, a full 6 months until the surrender, May 28th, 1948, the Jewish Quarter is under attack by the Arabs, by local Arabs inside the old city, by Arabs from the outside, the Jordanian Legion. It's essentially a siege within a siege. Fierce, fierce fighting, not enough supplies, not enough soldiers. The local population is mostly older people and families who fight valiantly but don't really have the tools. And ultimately, there's a surrender because there cannot be anything else. They cannot hold out any longer. The Jordanians, to show that they have essentially conquered the old city and it now belongs to them, blow up the major buildings. And this is a picture of the destruction of the Churva Synagogue. Okay, the Churva Synagogue, today, again, one of the highlights of the Jewish Quarter, big, massive, beautiful synagogue, the main Ashkenazi non-Hasidic synagogue, the place where the Ashkenazic chief rabbi is proclaimed, place where massive prayer services were held, an incredibly beautiful building. By blowing it up, and it was seen all over the city, this was a way for the Jordanians to say, we are in charge here. The Churva is the most famous destruction, but they also destroy the Tiferet Yisrael. Whoever is annotating, please do not annotate. I will erase you. Hold on. And it is an incredible destruction, but on the other hand, it's an incredible opportunity, because when we come back in 67, there is not a lot that is built up, okay? And there has to be a decision made what to do next, okay? And here's where we get to the narrator and the hero of our story, Professor Nachman Avigad. People who can see me in the corner here, we're going to be using this book, Ha'ir Ha'Elyona Shel Yerushalayim, the upper city of Jerusalem, which is the book that Avigad wrote after 14 seasons of excavations. And the decision was made to do some digging. Now, it wasn't such an easy decision, by the way, okay? In the beginning, when we come back after the Six-Day War, there is quite a bit of what we like to say in Hebrew, balagan, not really Hebrew, but you know what I mean, right? In Israeli, there's not so much clarity about what's going to be done, number one, and who's in charge, right? Who's in charge of the old city? Is it the Ministry of Religion? Is it the Ministry of Housing? Is it the national government? Is it the local government? It's all kind of spread out, very unclear who's in charge. Eventually, they create the Chevra LePituach Shikum HaRova, the society to rebuild the Jewish quarter. But in the beginning, it's not so clear. But even more so, it's not so clear, what are we going to do with this place? Do we want to restore it to the way it looked like in 1948, right? Remember what it looked like in 1948? Do we want it to be like it was then and make it almost like a museum? Do we want to create a completely modern quarter that's going to be the center of all the religious functions, right? The chief rabbinate, there's a concept of having a synagogue with 5,000 seats, right? Maybe this should be the synagogue quarter of Jerusalem. But as people start seeing here and there what archaeology is available and the opportunity, this once in a two millennia opportunity to excavate, they say, wait a second. First, we have to excavate. And they go to Professor Nachman Avigad. Now, Nachman Avigad was one of the veteran archaeologists in the land of Israel. Okay, he's born in the Ukraine in 1905. He trains as an architect in Czechoslovakia. He comes in the 1920s to Israel and helps to create the Department of Archaeology in Hebrew University, right? The first department of first Israeli Hebrew archaeology department ever. And he digs in all sorts of places. And by the time we get to the late 60s, to 1969, he's on the cusp of retirement. He's about to write a book and a lecture tour and take a sabbatical and all sorts of things like that. And the Antiquities Authority comes to him and says, would you like this project? And he writes about how he's torn. On the one hand, he knows it's an incredible opportunity, right? What could we find here? It's going to be unbelievable. On the other hand, he knows it's an incredibly difficult mission to go on, because while the plan is that while they dig and while they excavate, they're also going to build, because the goal is that the Jewish quarter should not be a museum, but should be a living, breathing community. Now, archaeologists and contractors, they are working at cross purposes, okay? The archaeologists want to dig down. The contractors want to lay the infrastructure, the electrical lines, the water, the telephones. How is this going to work? And he doesn't know if it's going to work, if it's going to be a disaster. And he finally is tempted, because it's such an incredible opportunity, and he decides to do it. And he writes about it, and I just love this picture. This is a picture, I believe it's from 1972. This is the Jewish quarter, okay, in 1972. In the foreground is what today is the building of Yeshivat HaKotel, not so far from the stairs going down to the Western Wall, right? In the background, you can see the buildings of the Christian quarter, the Lutheran Church, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's essentially one enormous excavation / construction zone where digging is going on all the time. And Professor Avigad states it in a very powerful way. He says, it seemed that the old city would never reveal its secrets, and only an extraordinary event would create a situation where it would be possible to do serious excavations in Jerusalem. And here we have that extraordinary situation. Destruction by the Jordanians, not much building by the Jordanians. Before we start to build again, what are we going to find underneath? And by the way, everyone who's familiar with the Jewish quarter, as opposed to the other quarters of the old city, knows, and I've had this experience many times, walking with people, if you walk in through the Shuk or through the Christian Quarter and suddenly you come into the Jewish Quarter, it looks totally different, right? It's much more open. Everything looks much more modern. People are always very surprised. And that's because everything above ground, or almost everything above ground, is from the 1970s and on. But underground, it's much older than the other parts of the old city. So it's this fascinating paradox. Now, they begin to dig in 1969. And they dig until 1982, okay? 13 years of excavations. Not only that, by the way, for the first 10 years at least, they dig essentially round the clock. They only stop when it's pouring rain. If you know anything about archaeological excavations, you know they dig 6 weeks, 8 weeks, that's about it. And then you go back to the lab and you look at your findings and you catalog and you write and you, they dug round the clock because they knew that the window of opportunity would close. And basically in those first 10 years, they did the equivalent of what we would call 40 seasons of excavations, right? Really incredible. And some of the people who dug with Professor Avigad, obviously he's not doing it by himself, become the leading lights of the next generation of Israeli archaeology. So people like Ami Mazar, Hillel Geva, Roni Reich, Lien Rietmeyer, who is not an archaeologist, but he's an architect and he does these incredible schematic drawings of what sites look like. So it really was an all-star cast coming to dig here. Now, they didn't always know what they would find. We're going to see one case where they knew clearly what they would find, but they did have certain questions that they wanted to answer. I realize this picture is in Hebrew. I hope that is okay for people. This is the only way. I only found it in Hebrew. In any case, I'm going to explain it. Okay? One of the burning questions of the history of Jerusalem is, at what point does the city expand from its original narrow little place of the city of David right over here? Let's draw in a little, right? The Jerusalem begins down by the Gihon Spring with this narrow little tongue, okay? Here's the Gihon Spring. And that's the Canaanite city. In the time of King David and King Solomon, the city expands to include the Temple Mount. So you still have this narrow little spot. But the question was, at what point, if ever, does the first temple city expand to the west, right? Does it grow further? And you have two theories, okay? One is the theory you have over here on the left, and that's the minimalists who say, no, it didn't. Throughout first temple times, the city remained this little minimal city, just this narrow ridge, okay? And only in second temple times, and not right away either, it took till Hasmonean times, does the city grow. The other position, the maximalist position, is the picture that you see here on the right, which says that maybe not in the time of King David, maybe not in the time of King Solomon, but at some point, the city grows to the west, okay? And just to give you an idea, when we say west, right over here, this is Jaffa Gate of today. Okay, so essentially growing in east-west terms to the size of the old city of today, right, and going further south than the old city of today. Now, both of these theories had their proponents. Each one was very, very sure of his or her opinion. Neither of them had any facts to base this on because nobody had dug up here in the Jewish quarter. So nobody knew if there were walls there. Nobody knew anything. It was theories. It was all very nice theories, but nobody knew anything. And Avigad, one of Avigad's missions was to answer this question. And indeed, he does. Okay. First, he starts to discover, okay, I know she's a little bit crude, but you know, she's like a Playboy model, but she's a fertility goddess. Okay. Classic first temple find. Israelites were very careful about not eating pig, but they were a lot less careful about not worshiping idols. We find idols all over the place in first temple Israelite sites. So Avigad starts to find up in the Jewish quarter, different finds that are from the middle of first temple times, from what we call Iron II, from about 750 BCE and on. He finds idols, he finds pottery, he finds what are called lamelech handles, tax handles, but that's not a proof that people lived up here. It's a proof that maybe they took a picnic up here, that they went for a walk, that they dropped something. This is not enough of a proof, okay? But then he finds this. Okay. Now, this is a wall that is in the middle, smack in the middle of the Jewish quarter of today. It's called the Broad Wall. This is a fascinating question in and of itself. After the excavations were done, or while the excavations were being done, what do you show? What do you cover? What do you put in a museum? What do you leave outside, right? And those are very interesting questions. But the Broad Wall was important enough that it was kept exposed. Right? The street level is where the car is up here. You walk and you can see this very nicely today. It's right off of the Chorva Square. And here you have this broad wall, right? This Choma Rechava, the names from the book of Nehemiah from early Second Temple times, but it is a broad wall, right? And it's a nice size wall. It is clearly a city wall. This is not a wall of a house. And based on the way it's built, based on the pottery that was found near it, we date this to the time of King Hezekiah, meaning 740s, 730s. It was a nice size wall. Take a look at this on the side here. This is how tall we think it was, okay? And it expands the city and it tells us where the city went to. Now today we found, and we'll see at the very end, we found continuations of this wall. But first of all, take a look at this incredible picture. I love this picture, right? This is a picture before anything was built up, right? And we can clearly see our broad wall right over here. So this put to rest forever and ever. There is nobody now who will say that Jerusalem did not expand in First Temple times. And in truth, if you look back at Tanakh, it seems pretty clear that this was the answer all along. First of all, we have in the Book of Kings, we have in the Book of Sfania, we hear about places that we hadn't heard about before, neighborhoods, the Mishneh, the Machtesh. Where are these places, right? So they're the suburbs. They're the suburbs that are over here. We also hear about King Hezekiah having to bring the water inside. Why does he have to bring the water inside? Because the city expands, because the city grows. So Tanakh certainly backs up this idea of the city growing. Why does it grow, by the way, in the time of King Hezekiah as opposed to before or after? Because in the time of King Hezekiah is a very important event, very tragic event. This is the time when the Assyrian Empire, this incredibly powerful empire, conquers the kingdom of Israel. Remember the kingdom of Judah, the kingdom of Israel, they've split. Okay? The kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes are conquered and exiled, but some of them run away. Some of them escape. Where are they going to go? They're going to go to their southern cousins, brothers. They're going to go to Judah. So Jerusalem has all these refugees and it needs a place to put them. And the city grows bigger. Now, why does he need to build a wall? Because King Hezekiah himself, a decade or so later, is going to rebel against the Assyrians. He's going to stop paying tribute to the Assyrians and he's going to rebel against them. And in order to prepare, he builds up the wall. So it all fits very nicely with our story of King Hezekiah. Avigad, this is maybe not the flashiest thing we're going to see. We're going to see the Herodian quarter is a lot fancier. But Avigad says he believes that of all the discoveries that they made, this is the one that has the most significance. This is the most important discovery Jerusalem of the entire 20th century. That's how he put it. And he discovered quite a lot. So this idea of understanding the size and the shape of Jerusalem in First Temple times, very, very significant. The other thing that they found, which is also very nice in terms of our Tanakh stories, right next to the wall, actually, let's go back here for a second. Okay, you can actually see it sticking out over here. Here's our wall, right? And here is like something strange sticking out. Now, this side, this is outside the city. This is the direction towards the Western Wall. This is inside the city. But there seems to have been something that was built before the wall was here, and it's kind of partly destroyed. What's going on? This is a house, or the remains of a house. And the prophet Isaiah, who lives in the time of King Hezekiah, he criticizes him. He doesn't like that he rebels against the emperor of Assyria. He doesn't like that he goes and builds this wall. And he says, "Et batei Yerushalayim svartem, batitzu habatim levatzer hachoma." And you counted the houses of Jerusalem and pulled houses down to fortify the wall. What happens when the government decides they want to run a highway through your back backyard. Okay. It's called eminent domain. They come and they knock on your door and they say, listen, we're running a highway through your backyard. We're going to give you compensation, but that's the way it goes. Here, did they get compensation? We don't know. But the house is abandoned because the wall is built here. So it's a great example of Tanakh. And what we find in the real world complementing each other. Now, just once we're here with King Hezekiah and the Assyrians, we might as well finish the story because it's a very important story. What happens? Hezekiah pays tribute to the Assyrians. Now, the Assyrians are this incredibly powerful, warlike people who conquer ruthlessly everywhere. And they've just conquered our northern neighbors. And Hezekiah pays tribute, but at a certain point, he says, I'm a righteous king. And he is a righteous king, right? He's a king who gets rid of all the idolatry, who turns back to God, who brings the people back to God. And he says, if I'm a righteous king and God's on my side, everything will be okay. And I can rebel against the most powerful empire in the world because God is more powerful than anybody. And he does rebel. And Sennacherib marches on Jerusalem with a huge army, terrifies the people, speaks to them and tells them that Hezekiah is misleading them. Okay. And they're terrified. And even the king is terrified. Maybe I made a misstep. And he goes to Isaiah, the prophet, and he says, what should I do now? And Isaiah says, don't worry. He goes and prays, and God saves the city. Okay, God saves the city. And the way Tanakh tells it is that the Assyrian army drops dead. Vayakumu baboker vihinei kulam pigarim metim. Right? It's a great line. They wake up in the morning, and they've all dropped dead. And what happened? Was there a plague? We don't know, but the Assyrian army retreats. Now, lest we say it's the Tanakh spin, of course, God has to win in the story. The Assyrians are not going to win. But in reality, the Assyrians won. Uh-uh. Okay. Number one, we have no layer of destruction in the city. The city was not destroyed in 701 when the Assyrians march on it. It's very clear when a city is destroyed, and we don't have a layer of destruction. Number two, we're going to see a layer of destruction in a second at the very next site we go to. Number two, King Sennacherib, like all Assyrian kings, loved to write about his battles and all the stuff that he did and all the conquests and all the enemies that he beheaded. And this is one of the places he writes it. It's called Sennacherib's Prism. We actually have three copies of it. Teeny tiny little cuneiform letters. And he writes, and this king I did this to, and this king I did that to. And as for Hezekiah, king of Judah, I shut him up like a bird in a cage. What does that mean? That means the siege. Oh, the siege was great. You would have loved the siege. Don't ask me what happened next. If he had conquered Jerusalem, if he had taken over Jerusalem, he would have told us. And he doesn't. He only tells us about the siege. So there's this feeling of enormous relief when the Assyrians retreat. And in fact, the prophet Isaiah, right, talks about Sennacherib coming down from the northeast and advancing on Jerusalem. And then he stops in Nov. Od hayom binovia amod, right? He's holding out his hand. He's going to conquer Jerusalem. And the very next chapter talks about what? The Messiah. It's as if the Messiah came when the Assyrians retreat. If that's how much of a feeling of relief there is in the land that the Assyrians do not conquer Jerusalem. Now, right next to the broad wall, this is a site that you can't see unless you get special permission and you go down into the basement of an apartment building, but it's really a few steps away, is a massive tower called the Migdal HaYisraeli, the Israelite Tower. And it's also part of this defense system. This is the northern defense system of the Israelite, of the Judahite city, right? Of Chizkiyahu's city, or maybe a little bit later. Now, Avigad says a fascinating thing, right? He says that they dug and they kept digging and they dug 10 meters down, 30 feet. That's pretty deep, right? They dug 10 meters down. They didn't find anything and they were really going to give up. But he said, no, our principle is we always dig till we hit bedrock, right? Till we hit the natural stone. That's nothing built up. So they dug another 2 meters down. They got to 12 meters below street level. And suddenly they see this tower peeking out of the ground, right? This massive tower. Okay, now what's going on here? This is a huge guard tower, and we'll look at it here. We'll see the picture of it. Okay, today we have two things. We have We have a guard tower from the Israelite period, and abutting it is a guard tower from the Hasmonean period, right? 500 years apart, but they both chose the same spot because this is a logical spot. Was it part, and look at the drawing for a minute, okay? Here's our Israelite tower, or here's part of it, okay? And here's the broad wall in the U behind it. Right? Was it one big fortification system all built in the time of Hezekiah, right? To protect the city, people coming into the city have to go through two layers of fortifications. Or was the broad wall built by Hezekiah? The Assyrians come, it's a close call, we're safe, but maybe we should build another layer of protection. We don't know, right? We really don't know which of these is true. But what we do know is that these two layers do not protect the city of Jerusalem when the Babylonians come a little more than 100 years later. The Assyrians are gone, but the Babylonians come and they do invade the city and they do succeed. And next to the tower, they found remains of ashes, of burning, of arrowheads. There was clearly a battle here, okay? And the city was not protected by this tower. So far we've got this amazing proof of the expansion of the city in First Temple times. The city wall and the Hasmonean wall, by the way, is going to be the same as Hezekiah's wall, but that we're not going to go into. But now we're going to jump ahead a little bit, different time period, and take a look at something that everybody who's been to Jerusalem is familiar with, and that's the Cardo. Okay, the Cardo is this big, beautiful boulevard, right? And what's fascinating about the Cardo is if you start over here in the Jewish Quarter, okay, you can walk through the outside part of the Cardo, which is what it was in ancient times, and you can continue into the inside part. It's been roofed over. And if you continue walking north, okay, you'll get to what the city of Jerusalem created in the 1980s, 90s, the kind of touristy Cardo with all these beautiful shops there. And if you keep on walking north, you're in the Shuk, you're in the Arab market, which is what the Cardo looked like in the old days, okay? Except that what the Arabs did was they took this very, very broad street and they carved it up into three narrower parallel streets, okay? So the Cardo is this major north-south street that goes ultimately, starts at Damascus Gate in the far north, goes all the way down towards Zion Gate in the south, bisects the city, built by who? Begun by the Romans, finished by the Byzantines, okay, 1500 years ago. And let's take a look at what it might have looked like in the old days, right? This is a beautiful painting they put up at the inside part of the Cardo, right? So you have this huge boulevard, 22 and a half meters broad, okay? Very, very broad street, right? Think Broadway, think Fifth Avenue, all right? This is a very wide, beautiful street, stores on either side, open to the sky. If you keep on walking north, you'll eventually get to Damascus Gate. This is used for not just shopping and not just thoroughfare, but it's used for religious processions because this is built in the Byzantine period. In the Byzantine period, Jerusalem is a Christian city, okay? You could see many different ethnicities on the street. The one you would not see are Jews, because Jews are forbidden to enter the city in the Byzantine period. They can only come in on Tisha B'Av. We know this from the church writers, from Jerome, okay? But you have many, many Christians who are coming on pilgrimage to the city. And part of what they do is they do a procession to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They do walking in the footsteps of Jesus from Mount Zion to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Okay, today we have the Via Dolorosa, which goes on a different route, but this is what they did 1500 years ago. And this is a street for processions, right? So this is the Cardo. Now, I'll just show you one more detail from the picture just because it's my favorite detail, right? On the side of the picture, next to all these kind of stock figures, right? They all look sort of canned, okay? But on the side over here, this is where I did the enlargement, you can see these three guys who have good, nice Jewish faces, nice Jewish noses. Take a look at these dudes, okay? Who are they? This is Nachman Avigad. Okay, over here with the red and the gold. This is Hillel Geva, another archaeologist. And this, some people may recognize, this is Teddy Kulik, okay, the mayor of Jerusalem. And they were put here in the picture in order to give, you know, as a sign of respect to show, you know, thank you for doing all this incredible excavation. So they put them in here. Okay, but let's go on, because of all the things that Nachman Avigad and Hillel Geva and all the others found, the cardo is the only one that they knew they would find. Everything else was kind of a surprise, but the cardo they knew they would find. Now, how did they know they would find it? Because of this mosaic. Okay, there's a copy of this mosaic in the cardo. You may have seen copies in other places. This is called the Medva map. Okay, it's originally, the original is in a church in Jordan. It was discovered in the 19th century. But it's a map that goes back to Byzantine times, okay, 5th, 6th century of the Common Era. And it's a huge map of the land of Israel on the floor of a church. Now, first of all, why do I have a huge map of the land of Israel on the floor of a church? Because in Byzantine times, the idea of making a pilgrimage to the places where Jesus lived out his life, that's very much an ideal, right? A lot of pilgrims, a lot of tourist Christians do it today. Well, they used to. But this is something that starts a long time ago. Now, you're sitting in church. First of all, maybe you're a little bit bored and you're planning out your trip. You're looking at the floor, but maybe you won't be able to get there, right? Maybe you're not going to be able to go, but at least you can see the places where things happened. And of all the sites on the map, the most important one, of course, is Hagia Polis Jerusalima, the holy city of Jerusalem. And what do you see in the holy city of Jerusalem? You have at this northern end, okay, ancient maps are oriented from our word orient, okay, up is east, up is not north, okay. Here at the northern end, you have a gate which has a pillar in front, okay. This gate is still today in Arabic called Bab al-Amud, the gate of the pillar, because in Roman times, there was a pillar with a bust of the Emperor Hadrian on top. It hasn't been there for a very long time, but the Arabs still call it Bab el-Amud. We call it Shar Shechem or Damascus Gate. And coming from this gate, you start to walk down a beautiful, broad street with pillars on either side. And over here is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and the street goes all the way to the south. And this is the cardo, and the archaeologists knew they would find it, and they uncovered it, and they found it exactly where it was supposed to be. This is the major downtown thoroughfare of Jerusalem, okay? Different than Second Temple times, where the major thoroughfare is over here next to the temple, but that's destroyed when the Romans destroyed the temple, and there are huge stones here, and you can't move them out of the way. And anyway, the action is not here anymore, it's over here. One interesting thing, not discovered by Avigai, but discovered more recently, and we'll see it at the end, is another cardo, a secondary cardo over here. This is at the back of the Western Wall Plaza, and we have found it today. Okay, but Avigad knew that he was going to find the cardo based on the map, and indeed he does. He does find the cardo, and it's a very exciting moment. And the way it's been redone and renovated is very interesting in and of itself. Okay, but we are going to move on to the real meat of the discoveries, and that's what was found from the last 100 years of Second Temple times. Okay, we're going to go to two different sites. One is called the Herodian Quarter. Okay, these are the houses that are underneath Yeshivat HaKotel of today. And the other site is the burnt house, really very, very close to each other. Okay, this is the time period where we really find the most artifacts. And that makes sense because we know at the end of Second Temple Jerusalem, the city is at its maximum size. It's an enormous city. It's an economic powerhouse. It's a tourist magnet. People come to see the temple, this incredibly beautiful building, right? It's a very important city and it has very wealthy people living in it. And where are these wealthy people living? They are living in today's Jewish quarter because you have height, okay? So you have good air, you have good drainage, you have a great view of the Temple Mount. And you have this complex that was discovered of six houses very close together that was given the name the Herodian Quarter. Now, who are these people? We're going to find that out as we start to look through the houses. But one of the things that's very striking is the houses are big, they're impressive, but they're literally on top of each other. Okay, this is not an English country mansion where you got lots of land all around. Think about, you know, townhouses in Manhattan. Everybody's on top of each other because this is a small place and there's cachet to living here. So you don't mind that your neighbor's house is 5 seconds away from your house. They're literally living cheek by jowl. So we have six pieces of houses. We don't have six complete houses. Almost all of them have a basement story and at least another two stories above. Okay. The largest one is about 600 meters. Okay. About 1800 square feet. Am I doing that right? No, excuse me. About 6,000 square feet. Right. I always get my math wrong. Okay. Huge, huge house. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Who's living in these houses? Okay. So one of the things we notice when they started to excavate is there's a lot of emphasis on purity. Each house has, in addition to the Roman style, bathhouses, bathrooms, water installations, right? Very classic. We're talking about the height of Roman times. Bathhouses is a big deal. If you're wealthy enough, you'll have a bathhouse in your house. But what's different here is ritual baths. In addition to all the other fabulous bathhouse things, you have mikvaot, and they're all over the place. And each house has at least two or three mikvaot in the house. Now, we know at Second Temple times, the end of Second Temple times, purity is one of those things that they are obsessed with. Every generation has its own obsessions, right? We would say perhaps today, kashrut is our obsession and your hechsher and your hashgacha. For them, purity, right? Are you pure? Did you become impure? Is your food pure, right? So the fact that there are many mikvahs in the house definitely helps us in understanding the time period, but it also might give us another little clue. Who are people who are the most obsessed with purity? The kohanim, the priests who serve in the temple. And we are right across the valley from the temple. Okay? The other thing we notice is that while we have these incredibly beautiful, rich mosaics, we have no images whatsoever. Okay? So just to give you an example, exact same time period as this, Pompeii, right, which is kind of frozen in time because of the volcanic eruption. You have gorgeous mosaics that have people, that have animals, that have women in bathing suits. You don't have any of that here. No images. Second Temple Jerusalem, Second Temple Judaism is very anti-images. Okay, so no images, very wealthy, a strong emphasis on purity, very, very close to the Temple Mount. The assumption is that the people living here are kohanim, are priests who are serving in the temple, right? The street right off of, when you come outside, you're right near a street that's called Misgav Ladach, also the name of a hospital, because the hospital was on that street. Misgav Ladach is a biblical phrase, which means a shelter for the impoverished. Avigad joked that after they discovered these houses, they should change the street to Misgav Lagvir, right? A shelter for the very, very wealthy, the very connected. Now, where are these Kohanim getting all their money from? Okay, this is no big surprise. We have this in a lot of places in Second Temple literature, whether it's in Josephus or in the Mishnah and the Tosefta and the Gemara. Not all Kohanim are like this, but you definitely have a segment of the Kohanim, particularly the ones in Jerusalem, who are corrupt. Now you have to understand that the Mikdash, the temple, is an enormous moneymaker. Okay, first of all, it physically contains tons of money. People give their half shekel coins every year. Okay, there's all kinds of gold and silver. It physically has a lot of money, but it also has a lot of potential for money. The temple buys, they buy oil, they buy wine, they buy sacrifices, they buy lots of things. It's very easy, unfortunately, for somebody to come along and you say, you know, my nephew is in the wood business. Maybe we'll give the contract to him and I'll get a little kickback, right? And it's very clear that this is going on, and we hear about it all over the place of this corruption in the Mikdash. And the strongest expression of it that I have found, well, there's a lot of them, but this is a very strong one. In the Tosefta Menachot, we have, I didn't bring you the whole thing, but we have a whole discussion about how there were certain priests who came, and even though they were supposed to distribute the skins from the sacrifices evenly, they would come and they would take for themselves from everybody, right? They would grab everything, and it just got so bad that the people who came to Jerusalem would say, we're not giving these skins, we're not giving these sacrifices to the priests, because they're just going to take them for themselves. And instead, we're going to just kind of give it up to the temple itself. And it culminates with this statement, this incredibly powerful statement. Rabbi Yochanan ben Torta said, why was Shiloh, right, the place of the tabernacle, why was Shiloh destroyed? Because they treated holy offerings disgracefully, right? We have the story of the sons of Eli and how they didn't treat the sacrifices and the people bringing them with respect. Why was the first building of Jerusalem destroyed? And everybody knows this, right? Because of idolatry, sexual immorality, and spilling of blood. They did a lot of things wrong in First Temple times. And why was the Second Temple destroyed? We all know, because of Sinat Chinam, right? They all hated each other, but it says it so much more strongly here. We know that in the Second Temple period, they labored in Torah. They were careful with tithes, we could add. They're very, very exacting about purity. Why were they exiled? Because they loved money and each one hated his fellow, right? It's a terrible indictment, but it's very clear when you see these houses that they were extremely wealthy and the wealth came from exploiting the people who came to the temple as well as their fellow Kohanim. Now, just to move away from that for a second, Avigad writes about how one of the things that was super exciting about this excavation is that we tend to know in history, we know about the great people, the leadership. In archaeology, we tend to find big buildings, the palaces of the kings, but we rarely get to find out about people's everyday life. And here we have homes, right? Okay, these are wealthy people, but still, these are homes, these are families. And suddenly we have furniture, we have dishes, we have in the picture here, you have some makeup applicators, okay? You have game pieces, you have spindles that are used for a loom. We get to see a little bit of a piece of ordinary life. What was ordinary life like, right? One of the things that we see, by the way, is we have a lot of things made out of stone, right? First of all, that we see dishes, different kinds of dishes that the Mishnah talks about, and that's exciting to see. Tables that are made out of stone, furniture made out of stone. Why would you make things out of stone? It's very hard to make things out of stone. It's not a simple thing to do. There are two reasons, right? Number one, we said they are obsessed with purity. Pottery becomes impure, meaning you're in the kitchen with grandma, grandma drops dead, all the pottery dishes in the kitchen have now become impure and you have to smash them. But stone dishes do not become impure. So if you are very careful about purity, stone dishes, even though they might cost 2, 3, 4 times as much, are a much better investment. Okay, so that's one thing. And when we see stone vessels, by the way, we know Jewish house, right? It's a clue that it's a Jewish house. But the other thing that's interesting is it's a side effect of Herod's building the temple. Herod rebuilds the temple. You have a lot of stonework in the temple. So a call goes out for stonemasons to come to work in Jerusalem. And you have a lot of young men who are sick of life on the farm, who come to the big city, who get trained as stone cutters. But the temple is built, 8 years passes, and now they're out of a job. Not going back to the farm anymore. I have this new skill. And suddenly you have a glut of stone workers. And so you have a lot of stone dishes, stone furniture, stone ossuaries that people are buried in, right? Beautifully carved and decorated. So you find a lot of stone things. Another great detail he found two of these little sundials, right? Can see the lines here of the sundial. You can see the hole where a pole was put in to show the shadow. And they found two of these in these houses. Now, why? Because Kohanim, unlike other people, need to know what time it is. Nobody needs to know what time it is. Nobody in the ancient world has a meeting at 6:47 p.m. You wake up when the sun rises, you go to work, the sun comes down, you go home, you eat dinner, you go to bed. That's what you do. But the Kohanim need to know what time it is because they are the ones who are giving the sacrifices, and sacrifices are connected to time. And that's the same reason, by the way, that we know the Kohanim are the ones who go up on the Temple Mount on Friday afternoon and blow the shofar to tell you Shabbat is coming. coming, because they're the ones who keep time, who keep track of time. So these star, these sundials are a great detail. And now we come back to our menorah that we saw at the very beginning, right? Now this was actually, it's displayed in the Herodian Quarter Museum, but it wasn't discovered there. It was discovered near the Broad Wall, okay? And what it is it's a piece of graffiti. Right now, you can see that this part on the right is the original, and this was redone. But it's very clear what the second half was. And this is a picture of the menorah. And not only is it a picture of the menorah, but take a look next to it. You have two other little structures. Okay, one, two. What are these? We are pretty sure that this is what we call the shulchan. Right, the table for the showbread, and this is the Mizbeach HaKtoret, the incense altar. These three items are in the Kodesh, they're in the holy, in the temple. Somebody came home and drew this picture of what it was like inside the temple. Why, what, I don't know. I always say, you know, Mr. Cohen, Mrs. Cohen said to Mr. Cohen one day, take the kids out of my sight. They're making me crazy. He takes them to work. They're super excited. They come home, they draw a picture of the menorah. Did that happen? I don't know. But it is an eyewitness drawing of the menorah. And it's fascinating because it is different than the menorah that we are all familiar with, especially Israelis, because it's on our ID documents. And that's the menorah of the Arch of Titus, right? Menorah of the Arch of Titus has a different base. Here we have this triangular base, which is what Maimonides talks about. Okay, it's just a different, it looks different. Was this the real one? Were there two versions? We don't know, okay? But it definitely makes sense that this is an eyewitness drawing of the menorah from 2,000 years ago. Okay, our last Herodian site is the burnt house, which is literally across the street from the Herodian Quarter. And it was one of the first things that Avigad excavated. And it's also a house, a very elaborate house. This one actually has in the basement, unlike the houses we saw in the Herodian Quarter, which in the basement are mostly water installations, bathhouses, cisterns, aqueducts, things like that. Here, the basement is more of a workshop. Right. And we see tools and we see vessels and we see things that seem to have been used to make the incense, the ketoret. Okay. And also mikvaot and a lot of the other things that we find. By the way, everything today is built up, but it was very clear that these houses had an incredible view of the Temple Mount. One of the houses I didn't bring you a picture of, by the way, the house that's the closest to the Temple Mount in the Herodian Quarter is the largest, 600 square meters. The largest, the most elaborate, the most beautifully decorated. We think this is the residence of the high priest of the Kohen Gadol, that just like, you know, the White House, the president, whoever the president is, unless he doesn't move out, right, gets to live in the White House. And so too here, the Kohen Gadol, whoever he is, gets to live in this Kohen Gadol, in this high priest residence. But let's go back to the burnt house. Okay, so they discovered this house, mikvahs, workshop. They even found something that perhaps might show who lived in this house. And that's a weight that says on it, Dibar or Dibare Katros. Katros is one of the families that is listed in the Gemara as one of the families of the Kohanim who are very corrupt. Okay, we hear about the Kohanim who are violent and who bribe people and who tell on people to the Romans. And Katros is one of those families, not exactly something to be proud of, but it is a family that we know their name. And here we found their weight. And actually, fascinating part two to the story, now that we are rebuilding the Tiferet Yisrael synagogue, which is right across the way from the burnt house, they found a matching weight, the same thing, right? Same thing that says on it, Katros. So it's telling us that this family lives here. But what's the most fascinating thing here is that Avigad found not just the house, but he found evidence of a violent end to the inhabitants of the house. He found a spear. He found an arm. Okay, see the arm bone. We think it's of a woman based on the biology, right? The anatomy. And most significantly here, and then later on in the Herodian Quarter as well, everything is covered with a thick layer of ashes. Okay, now when they dig down under the ashes, they eventually get to coins that are the coins from the time of the Great Revolt. Okay, year one of the Great Revolt, year two, year three, year four is the final one, 69 of the Common Era, the year before the temple is destroyed. That's the last coins we have here. So we're dating these houses and this destruction to the Roman attack on Jerusalem that destroys the temple, that destroys the city. Now, Avigad himself says he saw this layer of ashes. He understood, based on what he's finding, the time period. But he says, could it be that this is really evidence of the destruction of the temple? Now, we have to understand for a second, this is an incredibly powerful thing. We have been talking about the temple and the Churban and the destruction for 2,000 years, right? We pray, we talk about it, we commemorate Tisha B'Av every year, we read Kinot, but it's all very abstract. And here is something physical, physical evidence of the destruction that no one had ever seen before. And Avigad writes that he wrote in his diary, right, the day that he discovers it, in January 1970, he says, maybe I got carried away. Maybe I'm making up fairy tales. Maybe this has nothing to do with the destruction of the temple. And he calls in all sorts of colleagues and he asks their opinion and they all agree with him. And this makes front page news everywhere. There's the articles in the New York Times all over the place. And he writes about how, and this is, I think, is the most powerful thing. He writes about how people would come by to the excavations very moved. They would volunteer to take part and they would ask if they could take home a little bit of ashes, right? A zecher l'chorban, a memory of the destruction of the temple. And it was just a very, very powerful moment to have something that, as Jews, we tell the story all the time, but to actually see it was a very huge thing. So that, and I think also this kind of the full story, meaning we know the corruption, we see the corruption of the Kohanim, which is what leads to the destruction, and we see the destruction itself. So just to continue for another couple of minutes, okay, so Avigad and his team discover things from First Temple, really, major things from then, Second Temple, Roman, Byzantine, and later, okay? And then, of course, the Jewish Quarter is built. Now, things are still being discovered in the Jewish Quarter as well as all around the Old City, literally all the time. They did not excavate the entire Jewish Quarter. It wasn't possible. And even today, people decide to put in a basement to renovate something, and they find a Roman bathhouse, and they find a mikvah, and we hear these stories all the time. So I just brought you a few continuing saga pictures. So this is pictures of an excavation that's going on at the foot of Mount Zion, where they're discovering city walls, and it's actually an amazing picture if you look at it, okay, where this guy is standing. You have the Byzantine city wall of Jerusalem from 1,500 years ago. Where this young woman is standing, this is the Hasmonean city wall from 2,200 years ago, okay? 1,500 years ago, 2,200 years ago. And what you can't see in the picture, because there's not so much of it, but there's a piece of Hezekiah's wall from 2,700 years ago. Each one built their wall in the same place, unaware of the others, right? This one is 500 years after this one, okay? This one is 700 years after this one. They don't know about the previous walls, but this is a logical place to build a wall. So little by little, we are uncovering the First Temple walls. This is another amazing site called the Kishla by the Tower of David, by Jaffa Gate. We're finding pieces of Hezekiah's wall right here by Jaffa Gate. It really did go all the way out to Jaffa Gate. Another great new-ish excavation today, you can't see it anymore, it's covered up, but hopefully it will be eventually reopened to the public, is at the very back of the Kotel Plaza, of the Western Wall Plaza. The Western Wall Plaza was bulldozed very, very quickly after the Six-Day War so that the tens of thousands of people who wanted to visit there could come to the Western Wall. And they didn't do any excavation. Of course, they knew there was stuff there, but they didn't excavate. And only in the last 15 years or so did they start excavating and finding the secondary cardo, mikvahs from Second Temple times, and an enormous house from First Temple times, right? So this is all part of that continuing saga, a water system underneath. And one last thing, of course, not in the Jewish quarter, but the city of David, where they're finding unbelievable things all the time. And this is part of what's called the Pilgrim's Route, right? The street that goes from the Shiloh Pool down at the bottom of the city of David all the way up to the Western Wall. And that's being uncovered and eventually will be exposed to the public. So let's take a look and see. I see we have some questions. And if anybody else has questions, okay. Oh, these are big questions. Okay. You mentioned last class that King Solomon built a few buildings. One was the Milo. What is the Milo? Okay, not connected to this, but it is important to understand. The Milo is, Milo literally means limalot, to fill in. And it's the area between the city of David and the Temple Mount, right? The city grows towards the north. That's the expansion, and that's what we call the Milo. The UN did not condemn Jordanians. That is very true. How did they determine the height of the broad wall? That's a good question. I don't really have a great answer for it. I think it's more based on the fact of how broad it is would tell you how much it needs to support in terms of its height. That's more of an engineering question. Sorry, I don't have a better answer than that. The direction of Har HaBayit, not the direction of the Kotel. I agree. That is true. How do we know the idols are from Israel and not Canaanite? We do have Canaanite idols, but we also do have lots and lots of Israelite idols. And we know that at this point, by Hezekiah's time, the city of Jerusalem is a Israelite city. It is not, if you say in the time of King David, you have the Jebusites, you still have a lot of people around. By the time we get to Hezekiah, we don't hear about non-Judahites in Jerusalem. So if the city is Judahite, it's unlikely that the part above the city is going to be Canaanite, right? There's a theory about both Jerusalem and Rome that marshland outside both cities bred mosquitoes, immunity for locals, disease for the outsiders. Oh, so this is about the Assyrians. Interesting. I do not know. Tourists not as susceptible. I do not know. Herd immunity, early coronavirus. What was the population of Jerusalem when it was enormous? That question can be answered depending on who you are. Anywhere, when we say enormous, right? I assume you're talking about the end of Second Temple times. People say anywhere from, you know, 5,000 to 100,000. It's not a very satisfying answer, I agree. But we don't really have a great answer. What most scholars will agree on is that however big Jerusalem was, it doubles at holiday times, right? So that's actually a fascinating fact because it tells you that you really need to have a lot of resources for all those tourists, right? You need to have enough water for them. You need to have enough food. You need to have enough backup for all the people who are coming, right? Then like now, diaspora Jews sent lots of money for sacrifices, money and sacrifices, such as the Romans questioned and were suspicious of the flow from the Jews in what is now Persia, Iran, and areas outside Roman rule, i.e. a rival empire. Yes, there's definitely a lot of suspicion. We haven't talked about the Romans at all, but the Romans are very interested in the money in the Temple Mount. They're very interested in what's going on and fomenting rebellion, and that's why they're so interested in Jesus, etc. Sundials only work in the day. I will not argue with that. Sundials do only work in the day. I'm not sure what else I can say about that. There were many menorot in the Second Temple where they are identical. So Bina, there are many menorot in the First Temple, meaning we hear in King Solomon's temple that he builds, in addition to the menorah, an additional 10. But Second Temple times, it seems that there's one menorah in the Kodesh. Now, it's not one menorah throughout time, right? The Hasmoneans come and the menorah is impure and they make a new menorah. And then Herod comes and makes a new menorah. So there are successive menorahs, but there are not many simultaneous menorahs, right? Did that make sense? Timekeeping. Ancient Egyptians had water buckets with different holes, like a water timekeeper or an hourglass. And that works for night. Okay, thank you. Good answer. Why only one burnt house? There's not only one burnt house. It just got the name burnt house. But the Herodian quarter houses are also burnt houses. It's just a marketing thing. But you can see the ashes in the Herodian quarter as well. What was the Kohen Gadol's residence? That's this house in the Herodian quarter that seems to be the largest house, the closest to the Temple Mount. And therefore, thinking that it's the Kohen Gadol residence. It makes sense. It has a large area for receptions, right? Kohen Gadol is considered by the Romans, at least, to be the king of the Jews. So he's got to do a lot of stuff. Where can I find, read, see evidence of Bayit Rishon? I will try to send you something, Toby. Thank you. Thank you. How do you contact me for a tour? I would love for you to come for a tour. I will write my email again for everybody. Encore to the series. I agree. Let's do another one. Whatever happened to the little pomegranate from the Beged of a coin from Bayit Rishon? Yes. Okay. That's a very interesting question. Some people may remember in the old Israel Museum, before they renovated it, there was this little ivory pomegranate that was engraved on it, if I remember correctly, Kadosh LaHashem, right? Holy to God. The inscription, I think pretty much everyone agrees, is a fraud. And there was a time when there was quite a few antiquities frauds in Israel. Mm-hmm. The pomegranate, I'm not 100% sure if everyone agrees it was a fraud, but the writing, yes. And I guess because of that, it was removed from the exhibit. Okay, email, tours. Thank you, all of you. Do I take students who are studying in Israel on tours? Sure, I have no problem taking students studying in Israel on tours. I will write my email for anybody who would like, and you can also check out website, and I would be delighted to do another series on archaeology or on anything else. Thank you, everybody. Oh, what about Eli Shukrin's discovery of a pomegranate, Rifkaster? What are you talking about? Why is there nothing from Bayit Rishon in the Israel Museum? There's tons of things. What are you talking about? Lots.
It was a bell. It was a bell. Sorry.
There's the bell. Yes. Okay. So there are fascinating discoveries that were found under the street, right? Under the street that's by the southern wall. They found a bell, which may be from the garment of the Kohen Gadol, right? Maybe. It's a great possibility. They found a Roman sword, all kinds of interesting things, not yet displayed in the museum, but very, very interesting. The southern wall, the excavations there, that's a topic in and of itself, right? There's a whole lot to talk about there. Anybody else? Questions?
Okay, thank you, Shuli. We'll be in touch.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman.
Thank you very much for the series. You see how much people enjoyed it, and to bring Yerushalayim to life before and after and currently. And please go out to continue to build in the future. Yerushalayim. Amen. Okay, so I want to thank you again. Thank everybody this evening. Rabbi Benjamin Samuels, Benji Samuels, will be giving our parsha. Here's the rabbi of Shari Tzvila in Newton. He's a wonderful teacher. Everybody's welcome to come. 8:30 next week, of course, continue with our regular schedule. Menachem Liptag at 11 o'clock in the morning on Bayit Sheni in Tanakh. Bayit Sheni from Cyrus to Lord Balfour. Anyways, continue all this year, and we'll be in touch. Everybody, be well. Have a great day. And invite your friends, invite them to come once. I'm sure they'll be hooked and then they'll come a lot. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much.